meeting of Community and Regional Affairs to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:04 a.m. on Thursday, April 12th, 2007. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Present are Representative Olson, Representative Cisna, Representative Newman, Co-Chair Anna Faircloth, and myself, Gabrielle Ledoux. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody to turn off their cell phones. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up the following legislation: House Bill 232, an act relating to the sale, distribution, and purchase of alcoholic beverages, relating to a state database for records of certain purchases of alcoholic beverages, relating to the relocation of a license to sell alcoholic beverages, relating to procedures for local option elections for control of alcoholic beverages, and providing for an effective date. Would the sponsor of HB 232 like to come forward to present this bill to committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. It's good to be back at CRNA. I used to be the chairman of this committee. This is always my favorite committee. The only problem is it meets too early in the morning. For me, anyway.
I agree.
Before you, House Bill 232, this pertains to, well, let me go back a little bit. In 2004, the federal government...
Excuse me, could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, sure, sorry. Out of practice here. Representative Kevin Meyer from House District 30.
Thank you.
Thanks. In 2004, the federal government appointed the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission to study various aspects of rural justice services. And the commission recommended several changes to the Alaska statutes governing the sale and possession of alcohol in our communities. And last year, again, this was a bill that we had sponsored, the legislature passed the first part of these changes, and House Bill 232 before you is the second phase of these recommendations. And the main parts of the changes and of this bill are the creation of a database for package store licensees to keep track of written orders to damp communities, the prohibition of purchasing alcohol from someone in a dry community. Of course, it's already illegal to sell alcohol in dry communities, but it's not illegal to purchase that. The extension of the period before a local election can be held to overturn a vote to become dry or damp, and the establishment of a pilot project for alcohol delivery sites in Kotzebue and Bethel. Also, House Bill 232 contains a lot of cleanup language dealing with forfeiture laws, possession of ingredients for homebrew, the transfer of liquor licenses from within a large hub community, from an organized borough to within a city limits, and several other cleanup language. So, Madam Chair, I introduced this bill at the request of Department of Labor, and I'd be more than happy to answer any general broad questions, but certainly the more detailed technical questions I would like to defer to Department of Law, and you have several experts here that could do a much better job than myself.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Representative Meyer? Representative Newman, and before we get into that, I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Salmon has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Meyer, Mr. Finance Chair, I see we're spending $317,000. $269,000 is for contractual database. I'm assuming that you will try and ensure that that gets spent in Alaska.
Madam Chairman, Representative Newman, yes, this fiscal note is kind of just the start. We haven't really looked at it that closely. I think the reason why it's so high is the initial cost of the database, and once that's in place, then the cost should go down. We're going to take a closer look at this fiscal note as the bill progresses, because as you know, the bill may and probably will change as it goes through the committee process, and we do hope to get that down. But certainly, we hope that all the expense, all the costs, will be done in Alaska, and I don't see any reason why it can't.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions for Representative Meyer? Well, I go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Meyer. I guess my question would be, When you were doing your research for putting this bill together, what was your finding in terms of databases and information that are presently available? Did you find answers to your questions? Did you feel that there was adequate information, and was it readily available?
Madam Chair, Representative Cisna, to be quite honest, we haven't done a whole lot of research yet on the database system and what's available. But again, I think Department of Law has, and I think they'll have the answer to your question.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I've got a question. With respect to Section 10, possession of ingredients for home brew in certain areas, and that is line 25, page 5. It talks in terms of possession of sugar, artificial sugar, malt, yeast, etc., those items which are necessary for homebrew, with the intent to use the material to create an alcoholic beverage. Well, those are pretty common items that people would normally have in their pantries. So at what point and how would you decide whether or not there was an intent to use it for homebrew?
Madam Chairman, that's an excellent question, and again, I'd like to defer that to the Department of Law on how they would enforce that or interpret the statute. We may have to do some tweaking to the language, but again, I would let the committee and Department of Law work that.
All right. Well, is there somebody from the Department of Law here who might be able to?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I am from the Department of Law. My name is Talis Kohlberg. I'm the Attorney General, and with me is Annie Carpinetti, who's our special legislative liaison, who will fill in the blanks of the details that I don't know. But basically, I think you yourself as a lawyer would know that it depends, I suppose, on the circumstances which things are discovered. It's not unlike methamphetamine ingredients. All these ingredients have legitimate uses in and of themselves that are not illegal. And part of it would be the quantity, the circumstance under which they're found, and possibly in the circumstance under which they're being used at the time to establish intent is going to be no simple task absent circumstances accompanying the actual possession of the ingredients. So.
Talis, could you speak a little bit louder?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'd be glad to. Did you want me to just briefly discuss why I'm here and then go into the questions? Is that
sure? Okay. That would be fine.
Yeah, the Attorney General, by definition, is automatically placed on the Rural Justice Commission along with several other members, which I'm technically automatically co-chair of, and I'm here today in the capacity as co-chair of the commission. The other co-chair is Nelson Cohen, who is the United States Federal District Attorney in Anchorage, and he could not be here. The Rural Justice Commission was a creation of United States Senator Ted Stevens, providing funding for the Department of Justice at the federal level, and the United States Attorney General basically selects the members of the commission by definition. That includes some of us automatically. So there's basically been four new members placed on the commission in the last few months, including myself. Commissioner Monaghan is also one of the new commissioners that was placed there. Before we were there, this commission was created for four specific reasons, one of which was to try to address the problems of alcohol in rural Alaska. And you don't really need to go any further than yesterday's front page of the Juneau paper or the Anchorage paper, in which it highlights the problem the commission was created to address, and that is the disproportionate amount of alcohol-related problems in rural Alaska, and specifically in this particular article, it was the suicide rate, 58 per 100,000, as opposed to a statewide average about 11, which is no anomaly in that it fluctuates from year to year, but it's still disproportionate each year, and the year before it was 42, the year before that about 50 again. And so it's definitely, at least in the average, roughly five times the average of the rest of the state. And so when you look at all of the statistics that accompany lifestyle in rural Alaska as opposed to Alaska as a whole, you can see whether it's suicide, whether it's domestic problems, whether it's any kind of basic lifestyle problems that come from alcohol or drug abuse, that alcohol is clearly perceived to be connected to many of these problems at their inception. And so the commission was in fact created to try to address that. And so in the course of trying to address it, they set up several committees that went across the state, held hearings and formed work committees and tried to come up with suggestions. And they really compiled several hundred suggestions to try to improve the problem of interdiction of alcohol in damp and dry villages, where even the declaration of dampness or dryness doesn't seem to accomplish the intended result, because there is still a way for people to find alcohol if they try to put their minds to that. And so what can be done to try to further enhance the determination of dampness or dryness? And so of all the suggestions put forward, the ones that are before you today are what about 2 years of committee work and commission work before I was ever on it resulted in these particular suggestions as seeming to be the most workable, most reasonable, and most likely to have some significant impact to lower the grim statistic rate that continues to plague the state. So when the sectional analysis that you have before you talks about creating a database, it's believed that this would improve the statistic. No one believes it's going to make the problem go away, but it is a problem that we believe is going to be diminished with the passage of this. So that's just a brief overview of why I'm here. I'm here as co-chair in my capacity of that to endorse the work product of the commission and ask that you move it forward. And we hope and expect that this will make the headlines next year or the year after possibly less dramatic.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth and then Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Can you talk to me about interstate distributors and how we will proactively go out and make them aware that they need to contact or look at the database?
Well, we and Annie can jump in here at any point, but as I understand it, there are not that many distributors that are really involved.
Excuse me, Talis, could you identify yourself for the record again, because we've got two of you
up there. Yes, this is Talis Kohlberg again. I guess I'll just let Annie try to answer that directly, but we believe that that's a manageable problem because of the numbers involved.
Madam Chair, Representative Faircloth, distributors from outside.
Please identify.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law.
Thank you.
And I helped draft this bill in response to the Rural Justice Commission's recommendations. It is a problem for out-of-state distributors, but not that many do send alcohol in response to written orders. They are required to know which are the damp and the dry communities and to follow the law in that regard. And I'm sure that as the database becomes more mature, we will be making tweaks on it to try and address those people they're not licensees from the state, but those distributors who do send in from out of state. But this, at this point, it just addresses a database for in-state distributors.
Did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if we can get with the Department of Revenue, because we do have an active database, I'm assuming through an alcohol taxing function, that as we have intercommerce traffic with distributors of alcohol, specifically from the Seattle region, that we know who those distributors are. And I'm not sure if the sponsor would be willing to take it, but it's nice to notify people up front that the law is changing, so that we don't hear a year down the road that they just didn't know that it was coming. And if we have the database and it's available, which I believe we do in the revenue side of the house, then if we could get the revenue side of the house to give us those distributors' names, then we could have a mini education program at least with those that are distributing alcohol in the state, so that they're given notice that of our intent to change the law, so that there's not a I didn't know defense at some later point.
Through the chair, I think that's an excellent idea. I think the idea was to start at the beginning and fine-tune it as we made progress on the database.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kohlberg or Ms. Coulter, when I'm looking at Section 8, I don't have trouble with the idea of that, which when I'm reading it, it says that you're going to take away local option from a community to decide what their election laws are and changing them from 12 to 24 months of when an election can be held, and then from 16 to or changed, and then double that again from an 18-month period to 36-month period for other changes. Again, I don't have a problem with the content in that, but I do have a serious problem with the state telling local communities how they should be able to run their local elections. It's a big thing for me. I believe in the local control instead of Big Brother coming in saying this is what you have to do. I'm sure that there was a lot of time put in when they discussed and came up, and I don't know what this discussion is, and maybe Annie knows what the discussion was, of how they came up with the 24 or the 12-month period and the 18-month period in the first place. I'm sure there was a lot of discussion of how that date should have been set. How long is that date, that 12 and that 18-month periods, or the original periods that are there now, do you know how long that they have been in place, and why were they changed? Were they changed with consult to the communities? Were they changed? How did that come about? Because I, again, have a problem with the state taking over local governments and telling them what they have to do.
If I could start part of that through the chair to Representative Newman, I don't think we would perceive it.
Could you focus?
Thomas Kohlberg again. Yes, sorry about that. Representative Newman, I don't think we would agree to characterize it as taking away control, in that the control of the timing in the first place was state mandated to begin with, in terms of the decision locally is how they want to vote. It's a state statute that starts off with a time limit in the first place, so it's a state that sets the time to begin with, and so to say we were taking it away, we're changing the state rules, but the state established it in the first place. How long that's been in place, I guess, would be listed on the old statute, as the enactment date would be 1995, so that's been in place 12 years. But that was originally set by you in the first place, so it was not stepping in and saying, local governments, we're going to make you all give up. The state in the first place set those election dates, and so the state is changing the election dates. It's not taking, that's not a local right to set up the election in the first place on a community by community basis. This was a statewide statute.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kohlberg, you said that the state originally set those dates, which they have. They've been in place since 95, but you didn't tell me why and what reasoning was done to extend them out. And again, I think that this is taking away the rights of local communities to look at what they're doing. If they had worked within this 12 or 24 month, was there serious violations that happened? Were there, you know, what's gone on in the communities that make you think that we have to go ahead and change these? We have to double the amount of times of when you can have elections in your local communities. And elections in the local communities is where I'm getting at, is that local control. And has there been serious problems with that?
I guess I would be speculating as to why the timing was changed on that. I think Annie may have someone here that could answer that.
Through the chair, I'm assuming that the Rural Justice Commission, when they had their hearings throughout the state, got input from the communities, which suggested that it would be a good idea to give these local options a little more time to be enforced and for the communities to get used to them before they went ahead and held another election. These time limits were set when the local option laws were adopted. But Doug Griffin is on the line. He is the director of the ABC board, and he might be able to tell you how often some of the communities might want to have elections.
And for the record, that was Annie Carpinetti.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Colbert, Ms. Carpinetti. What would your opinion be on making an option available to the local communities if they want to adopt Section 8 or not, that time period? I would like to put that decision in the hands of the local communities. So I guess my question is, again, how would you feel about an amendment that would say local communities would have an option of whether to adopt Section 8?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, this is Talis Colberg speaking. I guess my initial reaction to that would be, what would you, would you be envisioning that there would be multiple opportunities for communities across rural Alaska to have different time frames for their elections that they would choose on a case-by-case basis, in which case it seems like then you would be abdicating the state's power to control elections to a local level, which may create a lot of confusion for the absence of the uniformity. I suppose it's workable. I think that what you would start to encounter is a system that is actually harder to regulate, which is what we're trying to do here, by different authorities coming to realize that the map of Alaska's villages in terms of dampness or dryness is going to be an ever-changing picture. I mean, if you truly turn it over to local choice, I guess you would probably want to set some parameters even under that circumstance, which would still be taking some control from that local choice, to say nothing below 6 months, nothing over 5 years. I don't know. You would have to set a limit somewhere, and that's all that's happening here. I was trying to refrain from speculating too much because I wasn't on the commission when the hearings were held, but my guess is that what's happened is that with a one-year time period, you have such a short time that if people are trying to avoid compliance, they can purchase a lot of alcohol before it takes effect, and 1 year gives time to try to have an election that might start to be obviating the whole purpose of the dryness or the dampness by having the constant recycling of the election issue every year. And 2 years is not inconsistent, for example, with a fairly standard election cycle across the state. It's not, again, I don't believe, intended to take away local power to determine things. Ultimately, the local power is the voting itself. We're just trying to create a standardized system across the state, and 2 years seems to be a reasonable length of time given election cycles historically.
Yeah. Mr. Colbert, do you think it might be possible to, since you folks have indicated that you might be speculating as to the
well,
reasons?
Well, if Doug Griffin's on the line, he may be able to interject here. I guess we need to first determine. Is Doug Griffin on the line?
Doug? I am, Madam Chairman. Doug Griffin in Anchorage.
Would you might be able to comment on Mr. Newman's line of questioning?
I believe so, Madam Chairman. My name is Doug Griffin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Besides serving in this role as the director of the ABC Board, I did also serve on the Alcohol Control Working Group, which was a working group that made recommendations to the overall commission that's being referred to this morning. The idea behind this, and you've got to read it carefully. It talks about specifically elections or questions on the ballot to remove a local option or to change to a less restrictive option. And the idea here is you might have a very vocal minority of people that want to just continually put this question of removing or going from, say, a dry status where importation and possession is banned to a damp status, something that would be considered less restrictive, and wanted to just continuously place this on the ballot to try to move in that direction. And the comments by your previous speakers, Ms. Carpinetti and the Attorney General, speaks to the fact that you sometimes do need more time to let these things try to work themselves out and become a part of the local community's law enforcement plan, if you will. So the idea was to just extend that time between those types of elections where you might have people trying to push their community toward a less restrictive option, to give the state of being damp or dry a chance to really work. So that was part of the idea, and this did actually spring from the group that I worked with, the working group. The statistics show that while alcohol as everyone knows, is a huge problem in rural Alaska, that communities that have chosen to go dry are generally healthier from various standards that are used to measure such things, and safer than places where alcohol is legal to possess. So that was the theory or the thought behind that. The comments of Representative Newman are very, you know, well taken regarding the whole issue of local control. But it was an area that we thought, by lengthening this time where they could be dry between elections, that would provide for a safer community.
Thank you.
Just one more comment. And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not advocating one way or another on this. I think that it's probably a good thing. But I just am under the impression that maybe the local people in their own local elections, the people that they elect to represent them at the local level, that's ultimately where the power should lay, and not in the hands of the state. And that's all I'm advocating that maybe this committee look at.
Thank you. Representative Cisner, then Representative Faircloth, and then Representative Salmon. And then I've got a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly align myself with the comments made by by Representative Newman, in that I really think that the power does belong with people in communities. I was in the publication business for 29 years, and this is a little comment before my question, but what I saw in that publication business was what probably the average citizen wouldn't know about, and that is the steady, huge amount of money that's spent in trying to sway villagers' votes towards opening up the community and going wet again. And it's huge amounts of money spent on one part of Alaska, and it's by special interests, and in an urban area, you're never going to see it. But what we know, all we have to do is look at our statistics, and that's one of my interests in statistics, is and what's really happening in the state relative to alcohol, is the enormous amount of money that is drained from rural Alaska, and then we pay it back in social services and the corrections industry. I mean, it's money coming back and forth in a really horrifying way. We really take away the power of communities through alcohol. And the strange disconnect that we have between other substance abuse, if we were to say marijuana or heroin or crack cocaine, we'd all be horrified. But when we hear about substance abuse with alcohol, it's kind of wink, wink. And it's costing our state so much. There's absolutely no way that we can afford what's happening. And this legislation, and I really appreciate the sponsor for coming forth with this, tries to put some necessary And you've gotten good advice, and it's been something that's been crafted over time, which is really great. And I do agree that what this really does is begin to give power back to communities that really have had it bought away in many ways. And my question is, I had several years ago, and so things change, conditions may have changed, but they were talking about going into an airport in rural Alaska and seeing forms for ordering alcohol on the counters at the airport, and being horrified in this. Is that something that this bill addresses? Is that something that would have been illegal anyway? Because what I keep on worrying about is if there's any state money being spent in any modes of transportation, do these laws apply? And trying to make sure that we as a state aren't paying for the damage that's being done throughout Alaska. And I'm sorry if I have a strong bias, but I really do.
Do you want me to try? Go ahead.
I would defer to Doug Gregg on that. I have never heard of that. This bill does not address that particular issue, to answer your question.
Okay.
But I would like to know whether Mr. Griffin, who's been on the director of the ABC board for 8 years, is familiar with that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Griffin?
Yes, this is Doug Griffin, director of the ABC board. I can't really comment specifically on these forms that Representative Sisson is referring to. I can only speak generally to the process of how most alcohol is shipped to rural Alaska to damp communities, and Bethel is the big one, and then Kotzebue and some other kind of regional hubs that are damp are also fall into that category. But that is through a process that is provided for in statute and regulations of the ABC board, and that's what we commonly refer to as shipment by written order. It is a pretty bureaucratic process because there are all kinds of safeguards there, but this is the way that people that live in an area where there are no liquor licensed outlets, package stores, or bars can legally purchase alcoholic beverages in a limited amount. They're limited on a monthly quota basis. And it is through this process that package stores, primarily in Anchorage and Fairbanks, but there are a few others in other locations around the state, Juneau and some others, do ship to damp communities, or can ship to places where there are liquor licenses, but perhaps they don't carry the types of the products at the local package store that people want to purchase. So there is a mechanism for them to have these orders shipped, and that's really what this database is designed to address, is that whole process. So there may have been some. There are prohibitions against advertising, which would this document that Representative Sisson saw, that would, in my mind, be run afoul of that prohibition as well. But there is a process. Again, Bethel is the largest community that has residents that buy a lot of their alcohol, primarily from Anchorage, by written order.
Ms. Carpenter?
Excuse me, if I could just follow up. I guess I didn't understand your question. The bill does, in a couple ways, try and regulate and limit violations of the laws relating to ordering by written order from a damp community. But when I said I hadn't heard of that, I hadn't heard of advertising or order forms at an airport. That's something I'm not familiar with. But as Mr. Gregg said, it would probably not be legal under the advertising provisions.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this was actually something that was said to me. I didn't actually see it myself. But I guess that would be my concern, that we not have counters that are paid for by the state in state funded facilities, making it easy, and I'm wondering if that's legal, but it sounds like not.
I would agree with you. I would certainly hate to see that, and I'm sure that our regulations and statutes would prohibit that kind of written okay. order form being available on state counters.
All right. Thank you.
But I will double check with Mr. Griffin, too.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Faircloth and then Representative Salmon. And before we proceed any further, I'd just like to ask the committee. This is the appropriate venue to be asking questions, and perhaps with respect to philosophical biases and so forth, we can do that when we have the bill before us for committee discussion. So with that, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you. I think Representative Newman raises a valid point in a consideration on the bill in Section 8 of the bill. But I would like, for the record, to ask the Attorney General to comment on that local option that he is asking about. And as I read Section 8, you have to go back to B and C, and my understanding is that the only local communities that would be affected are local communities that have already voted to go dry or damp or somewhere in the middle, and so that the local option and the change to the local option is limited to very few communities in the state.
Through the chair, to Representative Faircloth, this is Tallis Kohlberg. I think that was the point that Mr. Griffin was making over the phone, is that in regard to that section in particular, the alteration of vote, it's true, it's limited to the ones who have voted that way. I guess it would be statewide, and that anyone else who had stepped into this process could subsequently become part of that collection of communities. So it's not limited only to those who currently are damp or dry, but other communities that might also take up that status at a later point.
And just a comment there, those communities would already have an existing law, so it wouldn't change them. They'd know what they were voting into in that manner. The only other comment I have, I'd just like to point out that in our packets, we do have a letter of support for the change. And I know that it's a policy decision for us to take up, but the Tanana Chiefs Conference, we have a letter dated March 27, 2007, that actually support that particular change, as well as from the president of, and someone can help me, K-A-W-E-R-A-K?
Kawarik.
Kawarik, the president of the Kawarik, is that a village?
I believe it's the Nome Area Regional Corporation.
We also have testimony in here in support of that. With that, I'll yield.
Along that line, Madam Chairman, the Representative Faircloth, this is Tallis Kohlberg again. There were several hundred people involved from rural Alaska in the work groups that led up to this. This was not something imposed from the Commission without consulting heavily with Alaska's rural communities.
Representative Salmon, and then I've got a couple of questions myself.
Yes. I just like to make a, statement, and there's a couple items that I do have questions on. One is the local option laws that they have, throughout the state. Basically, it sounds good on the books, when you have laws. But yet, if you have nobody to enforce them, the law doesn't do any good. And a lot of times out in the villages, the state troopers are more busy with the more serious crimes other than the less, nuisance crimes, seems like, So it seems like they don't have time for dealing with stuff like this. And that's a big discouragement when you live out there. Here you don't, you might think it's a law here, but when you're out there, it seems like it's lawless, because if there's nobody to enforce it, it doesn't mean anything, You can put it in books, stack it, a mile high, and it don't do any good, if you don't enforce it. And those things that we really need to look at. If we're going to make a law, at least we do is enforce it, And that's my point. Because bootlegging, I've lived among it for many years, and just in Fort Yukon alone, it's soaking wet, I would say, but you have bootleggers there for 30 years and nobody do nothing about it, and to do all this, to me, it's just it's seem like it's a waste of time if you're not going to enforce anything, especially with bootleggers. And Section 10 troubles me, you know, because, as, you know, Representative Ledoux pointed to it earlier, I mean, these are just some basic supply items that we have in the villages. I mean, the villages, we have to supply, you know, especially with the high cost of items, you know. You know, it's not uncommon for people to bring in 100 pounds of flour, sugar, you know, and these are common baking items like yeast, you know, and we have big cans of yeast at the house, you know, and to have things like that, I mean, it's, and to be, to say it's lawful, I mean, who's going to interpret that? I mean, state trooper comes in, and if he thinks that's lawful, then he's going to enforce it, you know. And that's, you know, it depends on the officer itself, you know, and what you're doing with it. I mean, it's troubling, you know, to have something like that on the books.
Through the chair to Representative Salmon, this is Talis Kohlberg again. Representative Salmon, one of the other reasons the Rural Justice Commission was created was to try to address village police officers, and the one of the discussion points, even in the short time I've been involved, and Commissioner Monaghan has been heavily involved and is trying to address the tribal police officers and village police officers, the VPSOs and TPOs, and to try to create some uniformity of standards and to try to address the very need that you've been talking about, which is the understood absence of enforcement at a local level in many of these places. And again, it gets into a funding issue for sure, but you are absolutely correct that absent a enforcement presence, the laws don't amount to much. And so that is something that the Rural Justice Commission is also trying to address, and you don't have any legislation before you on that today, but if the commission succeeds in its mission overall, at some point you could expect to see something along the lines of trying to make recommendations in that regard. And again, in regard to Section 10, I would point out it's not the mere possession of the ingredients that triggers the law. It is the trickier part that Representative Chairman Ledoux was pointing out, which is the intent. And you're right, if a trooper makes a determination that the presence of the ingredients is in such a situation that he or she believes it triggers the intent, there possibly could be action that follows up, but we would, I guess, presume that the law enforcement officers would have some sense of what is actionable and what is likely to be a successful prosecution, and it's unlikely to be just having the ingredients individually in a cupboard in a kitchen with no other circumstances present.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions, and then Representative Olson. Page 2, Section 3. What is the rationale for prohibiting a purchaser to have alcohol shipped to another address than the address that's in the data bank?
I believe it's serial.
Through
the chairman to Representative Ledoux. Chairman Ledoux, I think this is to try to avoid someone in a damp community having a serial purchase of through several friends or acquaintances and making orders to circumvent the intent of the law.
But
And I'll defer to Representative
I think that Representative Ledoux, this is Annie Carpinetti, it's another way to try and limit bootlegging by written order, so that a person will order serially with from one liquor store licensee and another the limit they're allowed per month. And they will also, particularly, for example, a person who lives in a dry area will order it delivered to his friend who lives in a damp area down the road and then bring it in to the dry area. It's to avoid bootlegging in response to written orders.
Do you mean if you live in a village, for example, and you've got relatives in, let's say, I've got a couple of damp villages in my district, but Kodiak in general is wet, so that and people have relatives in places. So let's say that I live in Port Lyons or Yuzinki or someplace, and I'm going to have a party in Kodiak because extended families, friends, I mean, people travel all over the place. So somebody from Port Lyons or Yuzinki couldn't order something shipped to Kodiak? That's the
intent. I mean, you could go to Kodiak and you could buy it, or you could have somebody there order it if you were going to consume it there. But the purpose is to try and avoid people from dry villages getting other people in damp villages to order for them and then just bring it into the dry village, and in violation of the local option.
But follow up. I mean, if you were living in a damp village and you wanted somebody to order it for you, wouldn't you just have them order it, you know, in their name rather than your name? I mean,
this bill also prohibits that, prohibits somebody from ordering alcohol for another person in violation of a local option law. Because that's one of the ways that people can get around the local option laws is have other people order for them or order from a series of liquor stores. And right now there's no way for one liquor store to know if the other liquor store has already sent what the amount that's presumed to be under the amount that you can possess with intent not to sell.
And I guess one further question. Am I understanding this bill correctly that the government is now going to be keeping a list of how much people from the villages, how much alcohol everybody orders? So if I live in a village, then law enforcement, parole, the government basically knows how much whiskey I consume, how much wine I'm consume. I mean, they're keeping an entire database on my drinking habits. Am I understanding that correctly?
This is Annie Carpinetti through the chair. The purpose of the database, and it's not to keep records on a person's drinking habits, it is so that one, in response to written orders from a damp community, it can track people, bootleggers, who order from several different alcohol distributors a monthly amount that they're allowed, and it's a pretty large amount anyway, so that a clerk from one liquor store can check the database and say, this person has already ordered this much this month, we can't fill this written order. It's not for the state or the government to monitor a person's drinking habits.
No, I understand that that's the purpose, but in actuality, if I can order as much booze as I want because I live in Kodiak and nobody knows how much booze I order, but if I live in a damp community, then that's a record that other people, you know, regardless of what the good purpose is, people have a record of that.
Through the chair, well, you know, I mean, we would be certainly open to any suggestions. I mean, the bill states that this information can be used only for that purpose of making sure that the purchases are not in excess of the amount the law allows every month, and that they are confidential, not subject to the they're confidential, and they are not discoverable by anybody. But to be used only for that purpose. And, you know, if there are other safe, I mean, I understand your concern. I mean, it is a concern of privacy. On the other hand, it is a good tool to limit bootlegging by the licensees.
Thank you. Representative Olson and then Representative Cisna.
Well, before I get into the comments I wanted to make, I want to disappoint you by letting you know if you buy your alcohol at Safeway or Fred Meyer's is being tracked. If you use your little discount reward number.
Your salt.
So they've already got a database on you, at least the store. But what will this bill do to address the poison of choice in Kotzebue currently for the kids, which would be real cheap perfume that they can bring in by mail? gasoline and spray paint.
Through the chair to Representative Olson, this is Tallis Kohlberg. It really is focused on alcohol, and it's clearly understood there's all sorts of opportunities for other types of abuse, but that's really not the focus of this particular legislation. Yeah, those are all serious issues, and I suppose you could make an argument that if you make alcohol less available, that it might actually increase that type of thing. But it's not the focus of this particular bill.
I've been to Cosby a number of times in the last 3 years, as recently as about a year and a half ago, and at that point in time, we spent several hours with the woman that runs the rec center in Cosby, and at that point in time, she felt the greatest crisis in Cosby was not necessarily alcohol, but it was the inhalants and cheap perfume. Said after on a Friday night after the dances, there'd be dozens of containers outside the rec center of perfume that had been mailed in and then drank. But I would suggest to the chairs that if we really want to do some good with this bill, that we might hold it over and get Reggie Jewell and Mary Kapsner in to give us some perspective from their side, maybe make the changes in committee rather than having it done on the floor, so we can pass a bill along that would have the input of the people that are probably going to be most impacted, or at least have a better handle on it than we do.
I would add one other thing, if I could, through the chair to Representative Olson. The other thing to keep in mind is this is dealing with what is generally presumed to be a legal substance that's regulated, and some of the things you're talking about, well, perfume would be legal, but the use that you're, I mean, there are some things that are being used that are illegal.
Oh, yeah, but the three I addressed were all legal and available to underage kids.
No. Thank you.
Representative Sisna.
Now I've got two questions after that conversation, and I guess my first question would be relative to that conversation, and that is, I think one of the things that I'd like to have is a copy of the recommendations that were made, and I didn't wind up getting that, and I'm sorry about that, but I do think that sounds like something that would be very instructive, is to get that report. And is it, if it's available online, maybe just the address to that site might be good.
Through the chair to Representative Sisna's Tallis Kohlberg again, the version, I think, of what you're talking about that I have seen is a bound collection of comments at some stage in the process, so I don't know if it's online or not, but I think we can probably find a copy for you.
It sounds like it would be a really great thing, because it'd be all of those the reasons behind each of those recommendations, which sounds like there was a great deal of effort and a great deal of examples that would be good examples. And the other part of that question is, I'm thinking about this disconnect that I perceive, and maybe I'm completely wrong, and it's my own biases, but to that, and I do think it applies to this in a way, and that is, what, and you may not know this, but what records do we keep for illegal substances like cocaine and heroin? Do we keep track of what goes where? Is there a way to track that? Maybe in police records or something like that? Do we have records of those sorts of things?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. This is Annie Carpinetti, Representative Sisna. As the Attorney General just said, those substances are illegal, and they're not regulated by us. They're just illegal by our state. And I am not familiar with any type of data collection that we have on cocaine. I'm sure that law enforcement does have records in terms of prosecutions and investigations into, for example, meth labs in the rural areas. But if you mean like a stream of purchase, you know, where a person gets cold medicine. There's probably some data being generated as a result of the legislation that you folks adopted last year in terms of precursors for methamphetamines. But I don't know if there's if it's gathered together in one place, but I could certainly find out for you.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, Mayor.
That would be what this is Tallis Kohlberg through the chair to represent Cisna, what's been interdicted or confiscated, but that wouldn't necessarily be an accurate insight to what's out there in terms of
happening.
It would vary, I would guess, very dramatically from year to year, depending on who's caught with what.
Okay, thank you.
Does anybody have any further questions for either Attorney General Kohlberg or Annie Carpinetti?
Thank you.
Thank you to the committee.
Thank you.
Well, I'd now like to open the public hearing. Do we have anybody online who wishes to testify? I see we've got online Doug Griffin and Rodney Dion, but it looks like it's only for questions. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, this is Lieutenant Dial with Alaska State Troopers. I'm just available for any questions if anybody had any.
This is Doug Griffin. I'm also available if there are any further questions from the committee.
Representative Cisna?
Yes. Would it be Officer Dial? A title. Officer Dial.
Lieutenant Dial.
Lieutenant Dial. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Lieutenant Dial, just a follow-up on my question. Department of Safety have any collections of data that pinpoint illegal substances and where they go and how much there is?
For the record, this is Lieutenant Dial with Alaska State Troopers. Through the chair, Representative Cisna, we do have an intel unit that does track information on groups and specific individuals. I really would not be able to comment further on that without bringing our intel unit before the committee, but they do track some of that information on to try to link organized crime and things that would associate with that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions for either Doug Griffin or Lieutenant Dial? All right. Well, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Well, seeing and hearing no one in the audience, I'm going to close public testimony. So now the bill is before the committee. Do we have committee discussions here? Any comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Salmon and then Representative Newman.
I think Section 10 needs to be worked on a little. You know, to go, you know, to put a bill with household, products. I mean, that's common products, you know. And to me, that intent could be mischaracterized, you know, especially if it depends on which, you know, trooper or, you know, what they have the intent. I mean, you know, I mean. Intent could mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, you know, and it's just, it kind of bothers me to have, you know, household common products to be within that law.
I actually agree with you there because there, I know that you don't, in a village, you don't simply have, you know, a pound of sugar. I mean, you might have sugar for your whole year, and so that is a source of concern. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On 2 points, go back to Representative Salmon's concern. You know, that's at the intent is discovered, it's a discovery process by the individual police officer or community officer that wants to enforce that. And that's a lot of authority for a police officer or a public officer, community officer. And I don't know if this should be, maybe the community should discuss if it should be a court order, if there should be a discovery process that's decided from a public official. I unfortunately, there's good cops and there's bad cops, and I could see where harassment could come in on somebody, and that concerns me. Another concern that I have, and I like the bill. Don't get me wrong. I like the intent of the bill. And don't get me wrong there. But again, with the public or the government keeping track of everything that you consume, and we were just handed some information that's already in statute. And if you look at where it says 2, just about an inch down from the top, it says shall immediately notify the board of any consumer who places more than one or more orders written a month, you know, on wine, liquor, distilled spirits, or beer. They're already keeping track of everything that you purchase. And I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. That's a little bit getting into your life a little bit too much. But I do see the argument on the other side of how that can be for bootlegging it. And I think it's a question that this committee should discuss a little bit.
Representative Cisna.
I guess I would, thank you, Madam Chair, by the way. I can certainly hear Rep. Sammons and Rep. Newman's concerns about the harassment, because I could see certain personalities. We've heard testimony in other committees about harassment occurring given certain situations. I'm just wondering the way Section 10 reads, if in fact just legally, if it said in the conviction of, or something that would, and maybe that's not the way laws, yes, and if Anna Carpinetti could maybe speak to that, I'd really appreciate that. If it had some phrase like that which pinpointed the conviction of, or the that it's used only in that context, not harassment, right? That it would be the records that would be kept in case of prosecution, and then that would come in. It wouldn't be just something that a police or a VPSO could go in and see a bunch of stuff and say, "Okay, I'm gonna take care of you. I'm gonna write you up." And maybe I'm wrong. If I could ask that as a
certainly,
question.
Certainly, sure. I know you closed public testimony, but
in terms of prosecuting this offense, this will be very difficult to prosecute. I think the Rural Justice Commission thought, and the reason it would be is because not only do you, we could not prosecute, somebody like me who likes to bake cookies at Christmas and lives in the village and has, pounds and pounds of sugar and flour, because we would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person possessed these ingredients with the specific intent of making homebrew, and specific intent is difficult to prove. I would suspect that we would probably have to not only have ingredients, but machinery or equipment too, and even then it would be difficult to prove, because we'd have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person possessed these items with the specific intent to make homebrew. And we have these similar statutes in our drug laws. We have, for example, it's actually a B felony to possess precursors of methamphetamine, and those are common ingredients too that people have in their medicine chests, to possess them with the specific intent of manufacturing methamphetamine or some iteration of methamphetamine, and we don't prosecute them very often, but it's good to have them available when, in those few cases that you have the evidence and you know that. You can prove that the people possess the ingredients and the equipment with the intent of making homebrew, that you can prosecute them, because homebrew is a serious problem in dry communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions? I just wanted to add that, because I never did get a chance to say that, this is going to be difficult to prove, but it's I we thought it was worthy of pursuing, because in those few cases where we would have the evidence, it would be helpful.
I know it's going to be difficult to prove, and my concern is that while it's difficult to prove that because it's on the books there, that it opens up things for harassment of people. And it's one thing, you know, somebody brings you in, and then the DA says, looks at it and says, hey, we don't have anything there. Well, you've still undergone an arrest. You've still undergone probably attorney's fees. Your life is, you've been arrested.
You've been arrested.
And that's kind of inconvenient for most people, to say the least.
I would agree with that.
As a follow-up?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So that question, that interchange is kind of what I'm trying to get at. If, in fact, we had in that, it is on the books, it is something that somebody could look at and say, this is another way that I can, they'll remember that. If there's a way to put in here kind of a provision, even though it is, in fact, in the implementation of this, it's almost impossible to prove, saying that it's only going to be used as evidence, it can only be used as evidence, makes it, when somebody reads it, it makes it clearer that it's only going to be when you're trying to prove someone's guilt. And it's in the courtroom that actually this information is going to, I don't know, because you all have this question about it. And if that's the case, isn't there a way to put this so that it's very clear that that's the only time it's going to be used, is when it's for prosecution reasons and for proving the case, that you'd even have this information, that you'd even pay attention, not for harassing somebody.
But no? Representative Sisna, I think that kind of begs the question. I mean, all of our laws are on the books for prosecution purposes. And I mean, we don't stick into any other law that you're not supposed to be using it just to harass people. I mean, that just sort of goes to, I mean, clearly it's not supposed to be used to harass people, but sometimes it ends up being used to harass people.
And if I may, in this discussion, exactly, and I agree with you, but there, I think I've heard the same comment from three people, well, and myself, that I can see an instance where, in fact, somebody could misread this, some law enforcement person, and harass someone. And we have had evidence of that kind of almost bullying in a remote area by people who could. And I'm just trying to figure if there's a way to bridge that and still keep track, still when the investigations are made, to check and see if there's large quantities, but not as a means of harassment. Because we all think that it could be used that way.
Do you have any comments on that, Ms. Carpinetti?
I guess I'd have to think about how we could word it differently. I guess any criminal law could be used to harass somebody. We have worries about not having enough, and absolutely legitimate ones, not having enough law enforcement in this area. So I guess I would, being a prosecutor and being close to police officers, I tend to think that they do a really great job, and it's very odd, unusual case where they might be overdoing it in a certain way. The concern is, in our state, is not having enough law enforcement. So that's my only comment, but I would certainly happy to read, to work with you and see if I could come up with an idea.
Thank you. Representative Olson?
I really think we ought to give some consideration to extending an offer to Reggie and Mary to give us their perspective. We might be missing something really simple that would make this bill better, But considering that the impact is on their communities, I think it would be...
I think that's an excellent example. I would like to hold this over, have another meeting where we invite Reggie and Mary and any of the other representatives from the rural areas. Basically, include an invitation to the Bush Caucus in this meeting. And so that's what I would like to do with this. Does anybody have any other thoughts?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that'd be a good idea. And a little back to our discussion, you know, with Section 10, maybe the Attorney General or Assistant Attorney General could, I think we're looking at the word intent. And if we could add language to this bill that describes what intent is. And you said earlier you talked about methamphetamines. But maybe in this bill, intent could be if you've got equipment in your home or in the area that I don't know how you make alcohol, but if you've got a distiller in your home, you know, that I don't know what that is, but maybe you could describe what intent means is what is for that section. I don't, just a suggestion.
Would you let me do that now or later?
I think perhaps when we meet again and we have representatives here from the Bush Caucus might be the appropriate time. Thank you. Any other comments? Well, hearing Representative Faretoff.
Thank you. I appreciate the direction Representative Olson and Chair Ledoux is going with this, but it is helpful to have all the questions up front so that we can accomplish something with the Bush Caucus. And so what I've heard today, if I can be so bold, is that we have a privacy issue that we'd like to take up for discussion. And the policy benefit of providing confidentiality or access to that database. And then we talked about precursors to, like, the methamphetamine. I actually had an amendment conceptual to go, and so I would just throw it on the table so that Ms. Carbonetti has it. On line 29, I'll just read the new line, and Representative Salmon can see if this might get closer to where we're going. May not possess quantities of sugar, artificial sugar, malt, yeast that exceed personal use in excess of 1 year, with the specific intent to use the material or equipment to create an alcoholic beverage, provided beyond a reasonable doubt. That, anyway, the whole point is wordsmithing it so that we get to the harassment issue that we've been talking about. And then I think that it was valid to ask for a copy of this study because those who have met for the last 2 years to talk about this issue did provide comments supporting the extended election period and their thought that you could create a healthier community if you allowed a significant amount of time, and their suggestion was 24 months and 36, to look at the issue instead of having maybe lobbyists argue the issue back and forth inside of a community and influence the health of the community through outside influence. So those were the three things that I heard us talk about, and so it would be helpful so that when we talk to the Bush Caucus and that the sponsor knows directly where we're going, if we had any additional concerns on the table now before we move forward, so that when we do meet again on the issue that that we can to have the policy discussion. Thank you,
Madam. If there are additional concerns and anybody thinks about them after this meeting, why don't you email them to either Representative Faircloth or myself, and we can go from there, and we will get them to the sponsor. And why don't we say put a deadline for that by next Tuesday? Representative Faircloth?
Madam Chair, you and I have discussed how we manage meetings before, and I was wondering, since you're chairing this particular meeting, if we might schedule or see if the Bush Caucus might be available, not next week, but the following week, so that you could continue to chair that portion of the meeting. I don't know if that will fit into a time frame for scheduling, but that would give everyone, as you've said, a deadline that's achievable on the Tuesday deadline for any further questions on this, and far enough out that members of the caucus might be able to meet with us.
Representative Salmon?
Yeah, we're meeting at 10 o'clock today, so maybe I could bring that up to the meeting.
Good.
Good idea, Representative Salmon. Anything further today? Well, it is 9:20, and the meeting is adjourned.